If I had to be honest, our 3400 is the same quality as you get in a Steinway system. We don't know how to make it better. And you know, once you have the technology, we would not save anything by making it less perfect than the Steinway systems. My favorite band all time, of course, in terms of the actual music, is the Beatles. My favorite band in terms of sound and the music is Dire Straits.
O convidado deste episódio do podcast Música e Som é uma figura incontornável no mundo da alta fidelidade. Em 1975, abriu uma cadeia de lojas de retalho de hi-fi na Dinamarca. Criou a marca de colunas Dali em 1980, comprou a Snell Acoustics em 1989 e chegou a ser dono da marca britânica NAD. Mas foi no final da década de 1990 que Peter Lingdor fundou a Tact Audio, a empresa que criou o Millennium, o primeiro amplificador completamente digital, e o hardware com Room Perfect que permitia a qualquer audiófilo adaptar a resposta das colunas à sua sala. A reprodução fiel de um grande piano nos sistemas Lingdor Audio levou a uma parceria para a criação da Steinway Lingdor com o fabricante de pianos norte-americano em 2007. No entanto, o dinamarquês de 71 anos continua tão entusiasmado como quando começou a sua primeira empresa ao criar a Purify juntamente com Bruno Putzeis e Lars Risbo em 2014.
Thank you for being with us, for accepting the invitation to be with the podcast Música e Som. Can you tell me, please, when you established the Danish audio retail chain, Hi-Fi Klubben, in 75, how was the Hi-Fi business back then?
Well, actually, I started my company back in 1973.
73.
I was selling to Hi-Fi dealers at the time. And then that company was actually reasonably successful, and I was selling NAD, Servin-Vega, and a few other brands to dealers. But it was in 1980 that I started Hi-Fi Klubben, and that was simply because I was frustrated about the fact that nobody really cared about the sound; they cared about the margin and you know, how much discount they could give and how much credit they could get and things like that. So, and then I lost money on a couple of dealers that went bankrupt. And I thought, bloody hell, I better do this myself. So I started Hi-Fi Klubben 1980 in May.
All right. So it was a bit difficult then. Well, to sell Hi-Fi gear.
Well, it was, in a way, it was actually not bad because, you know, with the loudspeakers, we were selling Servin-Vega and they were louder than other loudspeakers, and that was good. And that was a lot of about what it was about at that time. So it was not a very sophisticated market, and there was a lot of sales to young people. You know, at that time, once you had a little bit of money as a teenager, the first thing you wanted was a small hi-fi system.
Okay.
So, and then of course, once the computers became cheap and so on, then that shifted into everybody wanted a computer.
Sure. Yeah.
So now it was in a way, a very, very easy market in 1980.
Mm-hmm. And then in 1980, also, you decided to create your own loudspeaker brand, the Dali.
Well, yeah, there was a little bit of a, you know, there was...
What made you decide to mm-hmm. create your own speaker brand?
Well, we were selling loudspeakers from Servin-Vega and... Boston Acoustics, actually, at that time. And then we thought, You know, there are so many good driver manufacturers in Denmark: Scanspeak, Vifa, Peerless, Hikophone, and so on. They all made very, very good speaker drivers at reasonable prices, and we had very good factories to make speaker cabinets. So I thought, why would we not make speakers that were specifically designed for Hi-Fi Club? So we started by making speakers for Servin Vega.
Oh, yes. I didn't know that.
That was the first real project, because there was a time in the early 80s, very early 80s, where the dollar all of a sudden cost twice as much as it used to do. And then I realized we could make the speakers much cheaper
than
in Denmark, because we would avoid the freight and all of that. So we started the production of Servin Vega speakers for all of Europe.
All right.
And that was very good for Servin Vega. It was very good for my business also. And then I started fumbling with making my own speakers. And I've always been making speakers as a teenager also.
Oh, yeah.
Privately and so on. So I thought, why don't we make a couple of speakers, two or three models for Hi-Fi Club specifically, really good quality, really good components, so we could easily compete because we were selling directly to the consumers. So that was an early start on DALI, but the actual foundation of the company DALI was in 1983.
In 83, okay.
83, yes. So it's just over 40 years old now.
Yeah, it's been quite a successful company.
It's very successful. It's a company I love with all my heart, because we have so many good people working there, and good management, fantastic engineers, and so on.
All right. After that, you bought Snell Acoustics also in 89, maybe? And NAD in 91?
Around that time, yes. I bought Snell Acoustic because we were selling the speakers in Hi-Fi Klubben. And then I heard from the CEO that they would like to have a partner, and he asked me whether I would want to buy half of the company. And I looked at it and I said, yeah, why not? So I bought half of 50% of the shares of Snell Acoustics. And also because, you know, Snell at that time were making some of the best speakers around. It was originally designed by Peter Snell, who unfortunately died before I bought the company. But there was very good engineering at Snell Acoustics. Kevin Bakes took over after Peter Snell. Very talented speaker designer. So I thought that was a good idea. And we started, actually, of course, the room correction technology at Snell Acoustics.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that after. Was the reason, because you started in the room correction hardware? But before at the same time, maybe you also bought NAD.
Yeah, NAD was kind of, it was a gradual thing, because every time they were running out of money, I bought some shares in the company. And in, I think it was around 91 that I had the majority, and it ended up owning about 90% of the shares for quite a few years. So... the intention was never really to buy NAD. The intention was just to make sure that it would survive and so on. But anyway, I ended up owning virtually all of it.
Yeah.
And that was pretty good, because I hired a couple of very good engineers, very talented engineers, to make sure that the quality was much better than it used to be.
Okay.
Because in the early days, they always made very good sound, but if you looked inside the product, it was a mess.
Yeah, and the reliability, maybe.
Reliability was so-so.
Yeah,
the buttons would come up when you push the front panel and so on. So
that's true.
There was a lot of things to do there.
Yeah. Was it during your ownership that the company shifted to Class D amplification?
Well, there was two parallel things happening. Already at NAD, I started selling NAD products in 1977, and I very quickly came on board on the product team in terms of deciding what products should be made and so on. So I was there when Bjørn Erik Edvardsen was hired. He came from Dolby Labs, and he was a brilliant analog engineer. So I was there when we decided to make the NAD 3020.
Okay.
Which, of course, became the best-selling amplifier in the history of the world.
I owned one back in the time.
Yeah.
It's great, still amplifier. Great amplifier.
Marvelously good-sounding amplifier.
Yeah. With a... the loudspeakers were the... were the seven of which was the brand, a British brand also, with the metal tweeter. I don't recall right now.
EPOS, for instance, they were,
sorry,
it could have been EPOS.
No, it was not EPOS. The one from Moik Ball, the company from...
Monitor Audio.
Monitor Audio, sure.
Yeah.
Monitor 7. Well, yes. I had a 3020 with a couple of speakers from Monitor Audio, the 7. Yeah, it was a great setup that I had.
I was in the room when we decided to do the 3020, and at that time, all the Japanese were fighting about having the lowest possible harmonic distortion from their amplifiers.
Yeah.
And they used, they actually had to make better resistors to measure lower distortion. Because as soon as the resistor was a little bit off, the distortion would be higher. And then I said to Bjørn Erik Edvardsen that, why don't we design an amplifier that is really good at driving loudspeakers rather than a perfect resistor? And he thought that was a damn good idea.
Yeah, sure.
So that was one of the objectives of the 3020, was it should be able to drive loudspeakers.
Yeah.
And not only a perfect resistor at 1 kilohertz. So that was one of the reasons it became such a good sounding product.
Yeah. And there is still some confusion in people's minds about the Class D amplification, once it's not actually digital. But you were behind one of the few, if not the only truly digital amplifier. As a matter of fact, I also... have one here with me. I have a Takt Millennium.
Really? Nice.
Yeah, it's my actual amplifier. Yeah.
That's a very nice story, because
What can you tell us about how it was born, the Takt Millennium?
Well, I got a call from one of my friends in Copenhagen back in 1996, and he told me he was working together with the most brilliant engineer he'd ever met, and he himself was an engineer, so that counts for something. And this guy had been working on a fully digital amplifier which would drive the loudspeaker directly without analog amplification at all. So PWM straight into the loudspeaker, just through a second order filter. And of course, in 1996, nobody thought that would be possible.
Possible, yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I wanted to hear the prototype, and I met Lars Risbo, who is still a very, very close friend. And he started to explain to me what his idea was, and I heard a very early prototype, which was a bit noisy. But there was something absolutely marvelous about it. It was just didn't sound like an amplification. It just sounded like the music. So I said, I really would love to make a product based on your ideas and so on. So I financed the product development and put up some of the money for a lot of the patents that he took in the next couple of years. And in 1998, we came out with the Millennium Amplifier. And of course, the Millennium Amplifier is not an amplifier at all. It's a D2A converter driving the speakers.
Yeah, I used to call it the power deck.
Yeah, you can call it a power deck. Yeah, that's also a good, good explanation. And of course, it became a huge success. Everybody loved it, and everybody were totally flabbergasted that it was possible. Sony bought two pieces. They called me and said, honestly, we have to find out what is going on. And I heard later on that the Sony guys thought that Lars Risbo and his team had invented some kind of new unknown component because they couldn't figure out that it was just by FET switching and those voltages and all of that. So it was, that was a fantastic endeavor. And of course, then in the year 2000, Lars Risbo sold his company to Texas Instruments. And he became chief engineer for TI Copenhagen, which were designing all of the Class D and fully digital amplification technology for Texas Instruments.
Okay.
And then in the year 2015, I founded a new company together with Lars Risbo and Bruno Putzis and Carsten Tingor called Purify.
Yeah,
back in the loop together now, which is wonderful.
Yeah. But before we go to there, chronologically, you had something in between. In 2007, you came it came the partnership with Steinway & Sons.
That's correct, yes.
And, to create the brand name Steinway Lingdorf. It is a high-end hi-fi brand, but we actually don't see it in hi-fi shows.
Well, you know, it came about because I got an invitation to visit Steinway & Sons because a friend of the owner and the CEO of Steinway & Sons, he bought a Lingdorf system.
Okay.
And then he called me and said, Peter, this is the first time I've heard a Steinway piano sound like a Steinway piano from a loudspeaker. Because we had the correction system, we had the boundary woofers, we had a lot of the things we're working on today. And he said, you know, I'm so excited. I already called the people at Steinway and say they should make a sound system based on your technology. So he had already made an invitation for me at Steinway & Sons in New York. So I went over to visit them, and we had a wonderful conversation. And, of course, I always loved Steinway for, you know, manufacturing the best musical instruments, or the most important musical instrument, you can say, in classical music, the grand piano. It's such an iconic brand. So I went to visit them, and we talked up and down about what a Steinway speaker system could be. And I suggested we would come up with a prototype, and if they liked the sound and the shape and our ideas about the visual appearance and so on, we should take it from there.
Okay.
And I promised we could reproduce a Steinway grand piano so that if you blindfold a Steinway pianist, you cannot hear whether it's a piano, an actual piano, or our Steinway Model D system.
Yeah.
And we did exactly that at a hotel room in New York, something like 7-8 months later. And then we made a deal with Steinway & Sons.
That's great. So the typical client for a Steinway-Lingdorf system already has a Steinway piano in his room, in his living room?
Of course. It is a very varied, they're very different people buying a Steinway system. Some of them are old-time audiophiles. I was just visiting a friend in Singapore who bought our Model D Steinway speakers. And he had been, he's a very wealthy guy, and he had been sending people to hi-fi shows for him. So he paid the ticket for people to go to the US and go to hi-fi shows to listen for what is the best sounding equipment. And he would buy that all the time. And then he heard our Model D and he bought the Model D. And then he asked, he actually asked me to if there was something even more fantastic I could dream of. And then I designed the LS Concert, which he now has in a special room in his house.
Okay.
So that's just one client. So this is an old audiophile. He heard our Model D and said, bingo, that's what I always wanted.
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe 40% of our customers are somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
We met a gentleman in Holland who was very skeptical because he thought this Steinway thing was just a branding exercise, and in behind everything would be a Denon whatever thing. And it was only when I started to talk to him about what is actually inside in terms of technology, and that we design everything in house, the correction system, the digital systems, the fully digital amplifier, everything, that he really wanted to listen to it. And he has, like, I don't know how many Steinway systems in Amsterdam now.
Okay.
So that's another audiophile type. And then, of course, we have very wealthy people that just buy because they think, oh, this is expensive, must be good.
Sure.
I have to admit that. But what I can say is that as far as I know, we have never lost a customer that have bought a Steinway system.
Okay.
So once they buy a Steinway system, They stay with
us. They keep it. They stay with it, with you.
Yeah.
They stay with the brand.
They never do anything else.
All right.
And we have some clients. I think the record that I know of is one client that has 11 systems.
11.
11, yeah. And that's from LS Concert to Model D and whatever.
All Lingdorf Steinway.
Steinway Lingdorf systems, yeah.
Okay. That's great. And let's get back a little bit into the room correction thing. You were one of the first brands to develop it properly, I think.
Yeah, there were, you know, Celestion in the UK, they made a digital equalizer, and there was another company, oh, the name escapes me now. They made also a digital, what they call the room correction system.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the Celestion system was that it worked only down to 400 hertz.
Oh.
And the other system worked only down to about 200 hertz. And it is from 200 hertz and down you have the problems.
Yeah.
So we found an engineer who
not really a correction room system.
it was not a correction system really. So we found an engineer who was really very sophisticated in using DSPs, a guy called Bozovic, and he designed then the world's first fully digital room correction system, which was also full range. That one actually had a resolution of 0.6 hertz, which nobody thought would be possible at that time.
Yeah.
So that was 1992. December 1992. So if anybody did anything that was actually working before that, give me a call. That was very early. And the of course, he did all the DSP programming and so on, and I did all the listening. And then we sent files over the early internet. You know, remember 92, that was...
Yeah.
Internet was extremely slow.
Yeah.
So he was sending over new correction files and so on. It would take an hour to download, and it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
So, but we did exactly what everybody else is doing nowadays, is that you make your frequency response curve, and then you make a target curve, and then the system is doing the opposite so that you fill in the holes and mm-hmm. cut the peaks and so on. That was what we did for the first, from December 92 to about 2002, for the first 10 years.
Okay. 10 years.
We did that, and we did it very, very well. And it sounded, let's say, our customers thought it was perfect once they'd done correction, but they always wanted to fix something. They wanted to experiment with cables and change the power supply and use the power conditioner and all sure. different kinds of things, because it was not relaxing to listen to. There was something funny going on. And it was only in 2002 that I realized what we are doing here is completely crazy. Because what you get out of a single measurement is a coincidence based on all the reflections from the rooms and so on. And what you get into the microphone is a totally different thing than what you are hearing. And I can get into that a little bit, but it was a eureka moment when I finally, at a Hi-Fi show in Germany, realized, bloody hell, whatever we've done is completely crazy, because we are correcting for things that we're not hearing.
Yeah.
And we're not correcting for things
based on measurements only.
Yeah, and there are different ways to explain it. And the way we finally cracked the code with room correction was that it was one of my engineers. After I actually hired close to 30 engineers over a span of just a few months to do a proper room correction system. Okay. And I told them that you're not allowed to see, to look at what we've been doing.
Okay.
Because it's a blind alley. The more perfect we made it, the more troubled I was with the sound.
Those first iterations that you were talking about, were they already implemented in the first Takt Millennium, the correction box?
No. Before that, we had actually done, while I was the owner of NAD, we had done an NAD room correction system using the Snell. So the first product out was a Snell DSP 6000, I think the name was, with a 6-channel correction system.
Okay.
And then at NAD, we came out with a 2-channel correction system. Or actually 2+2, so we could drive a subwoofer also.
Okay.
And that came out, I think, in 96.
96.
Yeah. And that was a full-fledged room correction system, very much like what people are doing nowadays. And it was virtually perfect.
Okay.
It looked really, really good. As long as we didn't move the microphone.
As long as, as you don't move the microphone, yeah. Okay.
So we had an NAD product, and then I found it. I sold Snell Acoustics in 1996 to Boston Acoustics, and then we moved the technology over to Takt Audio, which I founded together with Bosovich, the DSP guy. And there we also came with the Millennium amplifier. And so on. Unfortunately, my partner there became a little bit too creative in terms of how things were to be sold and so on. So we had to split up. And it was a very unhappy divorce. But in a way, it was good because that was the final nail in the coffin to the old way of doing correction.
All right.
Because then I started the whole new project and hired all these guys to finally crack the code. And it was a guy, who, Jan Appelgaard, who came as chief engineer from Bang & Olufsen, who cracked the really got the eureka idea of how to do wrong correction so that it actually works.
All right. What became with the Equibit technology that was in the TAC Millennium?
The Equibit technology is still sold as fully digital amplifiers from Texas Instruments as chip solutions.
Okay.
And that was, of course, the original design from Lars Risbo. And then he also made what was called Equilock, which is a regular Class D design.
Oh, okay.
So Lars was chief engineer, as I said, at TI, designing together with a team of engineers much of or virtually all of Texas Instruments Class D and fully digital amplifier technology. And when Lars sold the patents, of course, I got a lot of money back for the money I had put up for patents and so on. But I also got an agreement with TI that I could use the TI technology with inside knowledge about how everything works and so on.
Okay.
So even today, we're using that technology, but we get much, much more dynamic range out of it because we control the volume playback level by the power supply.
Yeah.
So, of course, we don't have a potentiometer in the system. And volume regulation is by the power supply, so we cannot have a channel difference.
The real secret is in the power supply, because there isn't actually a volume control.
There really is a volume control, and the power supply. we do the switching from a very very stable DC voltage that is completely without noise. And that has also become our speciality at Lyngdorf Audio, signed with Lyngdorf, to make these regulated power supplies where the noise floor is somewhere around better than minus 130 decibels.
That's great.
So this power supply assures that regardless of how much noise you have on the grid, there is no way it can go into your music. It simply cannot happen. So that's just one of the advantages about the technology we're working with, because first of all, you get, by regulating the power supply, we get an additional 26 dB of dynamic range. but we also have, in the same go, a perfect power conditioner in the system, which is, I don't know, a million times better than anything you can buy as a separate component.
Okay. So we can actually find these technologies in your entry amplifier, in the TDA.
All the have this technology.
In the TDA, I don't know which one it is.
All the TDAIs, all the Steinway TDA systems and so on have this technology. And it is... I can tell you.
You don't need to get to super expensive Steinway Lyngdorf to get this kind of technology.
If I have to be honest, our 3400 is the same quality as you get in a Steinway system. We don't know how to make it better. And you know, once you have the technology, we would not save anything by making it less perfect than the Steinway systems.
Okay.
And you know, the Steinway systems have a whole range of good ideas in the system. First of all, when we make a big, complex home theater system, of course, we make the home theater processor also. we make the correction system. We have a special way of doing bass management. We have a special way of transmitting the sound together with control signals out to the D2A converters, amplifiers. And we regulate the playback level out at the amplifiers, not in the preamp.
Okay.
So we can design a system with 70 channels. We can daisy chain the amplifiers 10 after each other, and the last one will have exactly the same performance as the first one.
Yes, the first. Yeah.
And all of these systems, we guarantee the customer that if there's any hum or buzz or noise, once the system is installed, he doesn't need to pay for it. So you can take a Steinway system that will rip your head off if you turn it up. And if you pause the player, you can go to all of the speakers and there is no hum, buzz, noise, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It is an amazing system.
Yeah. So you don't seem to stop. In 2014, you teamed with the Digital Genie, Bruno Putzis and Lars Risbo, and you created the Purify brand. What does this brand do?
Oh, yeah. That's, of course, it was Lars Risbo, my old friend from 1996, who he kept talking about this guy called Bruno Putzis, and he said, Bruno, he is better than I am.
That's great.
At last, you're joking. Then I started talking to Bruno, and Bruno said, no, the best engineer in the world is Lars. So I was totally keen on trying to bring those two guys together. And they're very different. Lars is very much an artist, and Bruno is just the most amazing brain in terms of finding solutions and so on. He's super ambitious. And honestly, Bruno Putzis is better at making Class D amplification than Lars Risbo.
Okay.
Which was a huge surprise for me that Lars would say that. But I must admit that Bruno can do things there that are unbelievable. And so we had actually rented an office with a guy called Carsten Tingor, who used to be the chief engineer for ScanSpeak, Viva, and Peerless.
All right.
And he was designing speaker drivers for Genelec and studio monitor companies and so on. He was designing the actual drivers for these guys. So Lars rented a space at his place. And Lars started to look at how do you design these drivers and how do you measure the performance and how do you measure the distortion? And Carsten kept telling him, oh, this is how we do that. And Lars said, but how do you measure this kind of distortion? And Carsten would say many times it cannot be measured. We don't have measurement technology to actually measure what is happening there and there and there and there. And then Lars said, oh, that's messy then. We need to know what is going on in the speaker driver. So Lars and Bruno and Carsten started to design a measurement technology for speaker drivers.
Okay.
And Lars then started to work on speaker driver design. So he went from being totally digital to being totally analog. Of course, using digital tools to simulate and so on. And so Lars and Bruno and Carsten as a team has come up with so many good ideas in terms of speaker driver technology that it's quite astonishing. And they came up with a measurement technology that is super fast and much more sophisticated than anything that was in existence. So, of course, now they make Class D amplifiers with extreme performance, and they make speaker drivers. And everything they do is with a better performance than anybody else in the world.
So you have Purify, you have the speaker drivers, and you have also the
Class D amplifiers.
Class D amplification. So I saw the little monitors that you have under the Lingdorf brand with those drivers. Yeah. They are curious because the suspension has this curious form that is...
That was one of... I can pick up one here. This is 4-inch.
That's exactly that. Okay.
Yeah. And of course, how'd the idea come, with this how, is...
How'd you come with that? With that
That was Lars Hesko's idea and Bruno's idea. You know, when Lars and Carsten and Bruno work together, it's almost impossible to figure out who got the idea.
Okay.
But the actual computer simulation to create exactly this shape was done by Lars Hesko.
All right.
And the idea is that this is completely symmetrical. So if you look at it from the other side, it's completely the same.
Okay.
And, you know, with a normal surround, it bends up like this, but this one moves a little bit more like this.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't change the effective area for the transducer when it moves. If you have a conventional 6.5-inch, then depending on the position of the cone, your effective area changes by plus minus 6, 7, 8%.
Okay.
And that creates distortion.
Sure. With that shape, it doesn't happen.
We have completely eliminated that source of distortion with this driver.
But this is computer modeling.
It's computer modeling. It starts with a good idea, and then it's computer modeling. Yes.
After Laszlo and puts some numbers, the computer cracks it and comes with that shape.
Yes.
Okay. And what about the amplification, the Class D amplification? Are you using it also in Lingdorf products?
We have. 1 year ago, we released an 8-channel Class D amplifier for our Lingdorf home theater systems. And we will probably also do another power amp with that technology. It's kind of funny because we don't really use the Purify amplification so much because we are running still the power supply as our volume control. Okay. And that means it's really, there are advantages of both systems. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, the Class D technology we're doing and the fully digital could hardly be more different because the fully digital has no feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And our Class D technology has hyper feedback.
Okay.
That has the strongest feedback loop ever designed. That's why the distortion is so low. But when you go behind the scene, you realize that with feedback, either you have to not do it or you have to have full control.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do something in between, you have so much dependency on the quality of components, capacitors, resistors, and all like this kind of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fully digital, we only have one coil, one capacitor, two components in the signal path. And in the Class D,
that's probably the lowest component count on.
It's super simple once you have generated the signal. But when that is set, if we did an analog in front of the Class D, you need to have a preamp, you need to have a potentiometer, you need to have digital regulation or something. Yeah. It's damn difficult to do it good enough for the Class D amplifier.
Yeah.
Because the best component in the chain now typically is our Class D amplifier. That's a component with the lowest distortion.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely difficult to make a preamplifier with such a low distortion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually quite remarkable because, as Bruno Puzzi is saying, Class D amplifier, the last thing it wants to do is a sine wave.
The last thing you want to do.
Absolutely. Okay. Force it to do anything other than noise. So it is the most impossible thing to do a good sound in Class D.
Bruno has been quite successful with his own brand, his Mola Mola DACs and the amplification. Have you heard it?
Yes, and yes. Everything.
And you like it? You like
yes,
it?
Yes, I like it. Everything yeah. Bruno is doing is fantastic.
All right. So, do you used to listen to music regularly? Of course, other than assessing the performance of equipment, for your own leisure.
I listen quite a lot to music, but I have to admit that I'm so accustomed to listen for the quality and the errors and whatever in the system that it detracts me from
enjoying it
sometimes from the music, because I've been so much into sound improvements all the time for so many years that it's difficult for me to listen to a piece of music without thinking about how it was recorded, what could they have done differently with the microphones, and does it have enough dynamic range and all of that. It's all in my head all the time when I listen to music. So honestly, sometimes it's a bit of a problem for me.
So we are getting to the final of our conversation, and I have to ask you, what music doesn't get out of your mind or of your head in the last month or the last weeks?
Nowadays my favorite band all time, of course, in terms of the actual music, is the Beatles. My favorite band in terms of sound and the music is Dire Straits.
Okay.
And so I listen to a lot of pop music still. I listen to a lot of jazz. I listen to a lot of classical.
Do you have any particular one you are always going to when you want to hear something?
Especially venue, you mean, or...
Sorry?
What do you mean, in terms of place or what kind of music or...
What kind of music? When you want to just relax.
If I really want to relax, I love listening to piano music.
Piano, okay.
Rachmaninoff, there's so many Chopin and so on. So many fantastic pieces. My favorite single instrument is the grand piano and the guitar.
The guitar, okay.
Because on the guitar you can change the tone.
Do you play any instrument?
No, never had the time. Never. And I don't think, honestly, I don't think I have the talent.
Okay. That's honest.
Yeah. I can hear if somebody is not hitting the right tone or if it's out of tune or something. But I can't find a melody on a piano. Never had that kind of talent.
Yeah.
Lars Lisbo, my old friend, plays a cello.
He plays a cello? Okay.
Yeah, in the Danish Chamber Orchestra.
That's great.
That's just something he can do. You know, I don't have that kind of talent.
Okay. And do you have any news? Any new projects and new things coming right this way in the future?
You know, if I tell you about it, everybody wants to kill me in the companies.
Sure.
But I can say, I work a lot with the guys at DALI. You know, they are also, I would say, they're also benefiting from a lot of the work they do at Purify. For instance, they have the special measurement technology for speaker drivers.
Are they using the Purify drivers already?
No.
No?
Not at DALI. At Lindorf Audio, we made a single product yet with the Purify drivers. But DALI, of course, have lots of engineers working on speaker drivers. They make the speaker drivers in-house and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Both in our factory in China and the factory in Denmark.
Okay.
So I think right now probably it's Dali and Purify competing about making the lowest distortion drivers in the world.
That's nice.
Which is a good thing. It's all in-house.
Of course, of course. So, Peter, very nice to talk to you. Thank you for being with us for this time, for this interview. And I hope we'll see you soon.
Okay. Nice to meet you, Fernando.
Okay, nice to meet you also.
Have a good evening.
Have a good evening.